Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the Ante Up headquarters in Tampa Bay, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now, here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's April 3rd, 2015. You're listening to the best poker cast on the internet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
This is so exciting, buddy. It's one of those times when you get to give back to those who give to you.
Wow.
Don't you think?
Sounds pretty deep.
It's our most popular dealer contest, of course.
Oh, I thought we were going to do an April Fool's joke.
No, no. It's April 3rd.
The people that fooled us. Like Jose Canseco.
But. No, it's April 3rd.
Oh, okay. Well, I know it's 2 days late, right?
Yeah, that'd be a real April Fool's joke if you pull it off two days later.
Oh, I mean, why don't people do that, right?
I know.
April Fool's Day plus two. You saw it coming 2 days ago, but nah, today you didn't see it coming, did you? I've been in here, yeah, but no fool here, no joke. This is it's really cool, and we got a good reaction already because we got the word out of it before we are mentioning it today. But we are doing what we're calling the Ante Up's MPD.
MPD.
Most popular dealer contest. And the idea is we just want to find, reward those dealers that make the game fun. You know, we spent a lot of time on this show talking about how much we prefer live to online. Part of the reason is that it's more fun and social, right? And right. And all that depends on having a good man or woman in the box there dealing the cards.
Absolutely.
And if you get somebody that's bad, then it's bad. It's a bad experience. But more often than not, you get somebody really good and talented and personable, and that's why you want to go out and pay the rate, pay the tip.
That's right. And a lot of times, they're the ones that make it fun. You know what I mean? Sometimes you're there and you're sort of like bored out of your mind. All of a sudden, you get a real energetic dealer popping in the box and just like, you know, making jokes and jumping around and still keeping the game flowing nicely. And you're like, man, this is why I come out. You know,
cause, exactly.
You know, electronic thing isn't going to do that for me. It's one of the reasons why I go to the home game too, just because the, you know, the personalities, the jokes, you know, and that's what you get from the dealers too. So we're just it's our way to give them back. We thought we'd have a nice little, we saw our cover story, a lot of you probably saw it, you know, who will be our most popular dealer. So that's what we're trying to find out here.
So yeah, so if you were a dealer, you can go to anteupmagazine.com/dealers and fill out the quick free application, and or if you know a dealer that you think would be perfect for this, let he or she know about it and tell them to go to that website, and they comply. You have until April 22nd. At that point, we're going to have our staff winnow down the applicants to the top 50, and then we're going to open that to voting to the masses. So all of you listening right now will be able to vote for your friends that are great dealers or the dealers that you like. And after we do that voting, five finalists will move on to a final vote where the winner will get a $1,000 prize package, including an Ante Up poker cruise. Pretty good prize, I think, for those dealers that make our game so much enjoyable.
Absolutely.
And the other four finalists will get prizes as well, too. And, of course, everyone who votes will be eligible to win prizes as well, too. We're going to do a bunch of raffle prizes for everybody that helps us figure out who the most popular dealer is. So, one more time, that website is anteupmagazine.com/dealers. And the deadline to apply is April 22nd.
And just to be clear, if you're the dealer that wins the Ante Up Poker Cruise, you don't have to deal on our poker cruise.
Yes, exactly. You get to come and relax.
You come and relax, play some cards if you want, and see how the whole operation works, too. Unless you're one of our dealers and you actually win, then we're in trouble, because then you're going to have to deal and... no, but actually, it should be kind of cool. I'm hoping that these guys, once they hear about it, you know, they start pushing for it and get all their friends a deal, and a vote, and... It's going to be a good time. I'm hoping that a lot of people come out and, you know, visit the website and do their voting. So, and it's also social media, too. I mean, we're going to include other stuff, too. So it's going to get all the way of, you know, communications out there. So we're pretty good.
Hey, I didn't think about that, but it's going to be kind of tough for our dealers, right? yeah. or actual working dealers in that cruise to have the most popular dealer in America.
They're going to have to swallow a little bit there. Exactly. And I love this next thing. We got it from O'Malley. He contributes to our show in a lot of ways. Sometimes he'll just give us some sort of news nugget or something happened in his game, whatever. But this is a funny story, and I can totally relate to it because...
No, when I was reading this was like, Chris, yep, everyone, yeah. That's Chris, good, yep, I can see Chris doing this.
So I'm going to read this. He says, my friend loves the movie Rounders, and it's not me. So he said, it's become his sick movie. Whenever he stays homesick from work, he dusts off the DVD and watches it. See, in my house, Rounders never has dust on it. But anyway, says he got sick one day, and he tore the house apart looking for it. He even asked his friends that he'd lend it to them and said, check places where he knew it wouldn't be. It didn't matter. He looked in his car. He looked in other places. Nobody had it. He couldn't find it anywhere. So when he never found it, he went to the store, you know, one of those ones that they sell used DVDs, which is, you know, blasphemy to me. You buy it, you repair it, you know, you replace it with a pristine one or whatever. But anyway, he bought a used copy of it. A few months later, same thing happens again. He gets sick, goes looking for it, can't find it. So now he orders a copy off of Amazon, which is more acceptable because, you know, then you know you're getting a newer version probably. Anyway, a couple months later, the same thing again. So now he's getting suspicious. Which, to me, I'd have gotten suspicious the first time.
Yeah, but, I was going to say, he's got a little he's a little more patient than you and I are.
Yeah, something's going on. So he orders, instead of just, like, questioning people, and he orders two more copies off Amazon and hides one. Several weeks later, he's having a quiet night at home when he mentions to his wife that he wants to watch Rounders. He goes to the shelf where he keeps it and makes a big show of it not being there. Then, without missing a beat, he says, it's a good thing I keep spares, and retrieves the DVD from out of hiding, where he's been hiding his copies, in her. And then so he says his wife can't contain it any longer. She tells him she hated the movie and had been hiding his copies in her bedside table. Long story short, she gave him his copies, 5 in total. Which he was able to give out as Christmas gifts last year. He still hides his copy of the film from his wife. So here's the deal. First of all, I don't know if I want to be his employer because he's sick every couple of months and missing work. Yeah. Two, how good of a job is he doing searching if she has him in her bedside table and he can't find him?
A husband that respects the boundaries.
Boundaries.
Trust me, there's not a lot of husbands out there that want their wives going through his bedside tables. So.
And what kind of a wife is it that does that? So underhanded. I mean, you know, my wife would never do that to me. She'd say, look, I hate the movie. You're not watching it in my presence. That's all there is to it. You can keep the movie. You're just not watching it when I'm around. She wouldn't do something like that. I mean, that's just terrible.
Well, I was going to say, I give the wife some credit here. She's turning this into a game, right? And the only downside I see to her way is that every time he goes out and buys another copy, that's money coming out of the household for no reason, right?
Right.
And I guess here's the other thing, too. I didn't ask O'Malley when this story took place. I'm almost wondering if it took place in the late 90s when Rounders came out. I don't know a lot of people that watch DVDs anymore. Now maybe it's a Blu-ray and you got special effects and the collector's edition with, you know, Edward Norton doing commentary. All right, maybe. But now, I mean, I couldn't even tell you where my DVDs are now. You know, if I want to watch a movie, I go to Netflix or On Demand or something like that.
I've got 300 DVDs sitting on my walls in my bedroom. I watch my DVDs still.
I watch
them on my Blu-ray player if I don't have the Blu-ray version, but I still do. I'm going to venture that this was recent.
Well, that's more because you've had them, right? I mean, do you still go out and buy DVDs now?
I will go out and buy Blu-rays, not DVDs, but I have DVDs.
Right, that's a separate. I mean, yeah, I'm not throwing my DVDs out that I have.
Right.
I'll watch them. But this guy, it disappeared, right?
Yeah.
And his first reaction is to run down to the Quickie Mart and, you know, buy another one. And then go on Amazon and buy another one and then buy two more. At some point, I would say, you know what? I'm going to pay the $16 for Netflix and just not ever have to buy this ever again, right?
Yeah, but you got to pay it every month.
Well, yeah, but you got to You know, see, normal people watch more than just one movie. See, you and this guy are
there
not.
You go. That's the reason why he's not doing it, because he only watches Rounders. That's it. I understand. And he gave him out his Christmas gifts last year, so I'm assuming it was within the last year.
Oh, that's
so
true. Yeah.
So I would believe that that's what he's done. And I don't blame the guy. I would want to keep it. I mean, maybe they meant Blu-ray disc, you know. Maybe he did buy it on Blu-ray. But you know what? Any movies that were made like before 2010 or 9, and when you buy the Blu-ray version, they're not good anyway. They're still
say, it's even a waste, right?
So yeah. Just buy the DVD version and save yourself some money. So hats off to this guy, but he's got to work on his searching skills, because that right next to his bed, and he couldn't find him. Come on.
Yeah, he's gonna get a private investigator on retainer or something.
Something's not right there.
But, exactly.
And not all of us can be like you, Rockefeller, getting all these subscription sites, you know, or Blu-ray players. You know, we're not all millionaires.
What can I say? I like movies, plural.
All right, we got our any updates. See how that works there, Scott? You say it right the first time. You don't have to worry about saying it.
But I'm going to hide that sometime, and then you're not going to know where any updates are. You'll be lost.
Feel free to join the Anti-Up Nation online every Sunday night at 8 Eastern Time at AdvancedPokerTraining.com for our co-branded series. Just create a free account to be able to play, and don't forget PAPES, our free online fan series, which holds events on all dates ending in a 6. So next events are April 6th, April 16th, and April 26th. Not April 36th, though. That won't happen.
Yeah, you'd be looking for the wrong time.
Details on both can be found in our Ante Up Nation's events group discussion on PokerRadius.com. And don't forget, too, it's time for us to keep building up our bench of possible Ante Up ambassadors. So if you'd like to be one of our monthly magazine contributors and represent Ante Up in your home area, apply at AnteUpMagazine.com/ambassadors. Each week we spotlight a listener who calls our hotline at 206-338-6344 or emails us at podcast@anteupmagazine.com. And if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with Call the Floor and Hand of the Week, we send them something cool. It comes from Everett Clark. It says, I've tried to take my poker playing more serious, and I keep a running tally of tournaments played. I always went by the year, and then I would filter the types of games into subcategories, such as home game, sit-and-go, bar tournament, regular tournament. Large buy-in, you know, anything more than $150. Daily tournaments, he puts bingo in parentheses, you know, $50 to $100. And then Bar League, no money. Recently, I've seen 10% win rate for dailies, 50% for Bar Leagues, and 30% for large buy-ins. How does one keep track of tournament play? Should I keep it all together or subcategorize it? I never really sat down and looked at the overall big picture, but now that I have, I like my results. What do you think, Scott?
All right, first thing I'll say is... if you're comfortable collecting information, the more information you can collect is always a good thing, right? Because if 5 years from now you realize you want to go back and look at something and you weren't collecting more stuff back then, you can never get it back, right? So I think the people that want to take the information, I would even go beyond that if you're that type of person that wants to, you know, what day of the week was it, morning or night, you know, what else was going on in your life that day? Or did you just have a fight with the wife because she stole your Rounders copy, or... you know, were you sick and then going to work, or, you know, something like that. And the more information that you can keep on your play, the better it is. Now, the caveat being, it takes a real special person to be able to properly analyze information, I think. And I don't think a lot of us are the proper person.
No.
So, you know, sometimes you can overwhelm yourself with information. Sometimes you can, you know, misinterpret it. And I think we see that not just in people that track their poker play, but really anything like, you spend 5 minutes on Facebook, and I know you don't spend 5 minutes on Facebook, but you spend 5 minutes on Facebook, you're going to see somebody, you know, quoting some survey or poll or stat to support their political view, and it's taken way out of context, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes on purpose, but often it's just, you know, they don't understand the subtlety of it, right? So I would think if you go in and you're analyzing, you're not analyzing correctly, you might make some incorrect assumptions based on your play with that. But I think there's nothing wrong with having as much information as you have, storing it, and then maybe you start just by, I mean, you already started on pretty basic stuff here. I mean, big tournaments, you know, daily tournaments, things like that, and got... and got a good piece of information, you know, that he's realizing he's playing better than he thought he was. So that's good. So now the next step is to, you know, work in another piece of the information and really drill down. But Just be sure, you know, I would collect as much as you can, but just don't overwhelm yourself in the analysis until you feel comfortable.
And here's the question then. What will be his goal? He needs a goal for this analysis. Because, okay, so every year I've got these list of stats, and here's how I did in these things. But if you're not going to now tailor your playing accordingly. So I seem to do very well in large buy-ins, using his stats alone. Do well in bar leagues, and I do about average for the dailies. So, okay, should I continue to play large buy-ins, or will ultimately all of these things come victim to variance, and then all of a sudden you're 10% across the board or 15% across the board, and then all of a sudden you're not really getting any information from this. So I think you need to extract something from this and then make modifications. Otherwise, all you're doing is keeping a bunch of numbers that's not doing anything for you.
Right, yeah. Good point.
I don't see the reason behind playing bar league tournaments anymore for him. If he's actually playing tournaments that are more than $150 and cashing 30% of the time in them, why are you playing for nothing? Right. And playing and getting into those bad habits of players who are just learning the game, or I would get out of that and start to think about, you know, just playing what you're comfortable with as far as a buy-ins. I think the bar leagues really will only hurt these kind of stats. Means nothing to me that you're cashing 50% of the time in these bar leagues. Nothing.
Right.
It accomplishes nothing for your, because it sounds to me like Everett's pretty serious about it. Otherwise, why would he be keeping stats? So any serious player needs to say, okay, the bar leagues will serve their purpose to get me into the element or to get me used to the rules of the game or something. But get rid of it now. Let it go and concentrate on actual money, where, you know, home games might be something that, I mean, I don't know what the stats are in home games or sit and goes, but you need to find a value amount that you're comfortable with and then decide, I do better with X, so I'm going to play X. But when you're going from free to 50 to over 150, you've got it's like entering a $10,000 event and then entering a $500 event. And then entering a free roll. I mean, there's no reason to do all those different things. You're obviously a capable player if you're cashing 30% of the time and buy-ins bigger than 150. So get rid of the bar leagues.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it all depends on what you're looking at, too. I mean, maybe he goes to bar league because it's part of the enjoyment. You know, he goes out and has a beer with his friends and plays. And again, I don't think there's anything wrong with keeping stats on that, too. But again, that's part of the analysis, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you're right, if your goal is to say, where do I do the best, obviously by the numbers he's given us, he does the best at bar leagues. So, you know, if he decides, okay, well, I guess I'm just going to focus on bar leagues now, that's probably a misinterpretation of the statistics, right?
Right.
At least in terms of the goal, if the goal is to become a really good poker player. So a lot of it depends on what you want to do. So I wouldn't necessarily say not to go. I wouldn't necessarily say not to keep the stats on it. But I would, again, stress that you have to be sure you know what you're looking for. And that takes some time. And not all of us are well-suited for that kind of analysis. So it might be something where you just collect all that information and then give it to a buddy and say, hey, look at what I've done. I've collected all this stuff. Help me look through it and help me. You tell me what you think you see when you see this stuff.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. Okay, find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and you're not sure what the proper ruling should have been, email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com and we'll have Golden Nugget Las Vegas Poker Director Sam Minatello tell you how he would have ruled. This week's sponsor is PokerRadius.com, poker's newest social networking site and home to the Anti-Up group discussions. Comes from Steven, says we're in a 3-5 no-limit hold'em cash game in a Northern California casino. After the flop, seat one bets $45. Seat 7 moves all of his chips across the line, and the dealer tosses him the all-in button. Seat 6 pushes $45 to the betting line, intending to call the initial $45 bet, unaware of the all-in. Dealer informs him that there was an all-in bet, and that he must make the call to $305 and can't simply forfeit the $45. The floor is called, who confirms that the player must call the all-in, citing that the call is the same as tossing a single chip into the pot to call the all-in. A shift boss confirms the floor's ruling. Was the ruling correct? In the end, the two players agreed to a deal where seat 6 forfeited the $45 and the pot to seat 7.
Wow, very thorough on this.
Yeah, well, good.
I'm pretty sure the casino owner was going to be the next to come down to the ruling.
I would probably insist on that, too, if I was upset with something.
All right, Sam says, every poker room has its own set of standardized rules. Certain interpretations of the rules may differ from property to property. What defines a wager is one of the rules that differs the most from poker room to poker room. I don't honor the tossing in a single chip to call an all-in wager. My opinion is there needs to be more evidence of a commitment than just tossing in a single chip. Now, because I don't honor this rule in my poker room doesn't mean it should be outlawed across the land. Would I like to see a standardized set of house rules for cash games like the TDA does for tournaments? Of course I would. However, sometimes properties like to offer different variations of the rules to attract customers. The bottom line is, if the ruling made was 100% consistent with the poster house rules, then I would have to say yes, it was a correct call. Players should make more of an effort to familiarize themselves with the house rules to protect themselves from getting into a sticky situation. I would also like to see poker rooms that do not enforce the betting line to remove them from the tables. This would eliminate a lot of confusion and help games run smoother.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, is that when I get the...
Well, no, I agree with him. I feel bad for the guy because, okay, yes, ultimately it comes down to his responsibility to know there was an all-in. But I've never had that happen where the guy puts out what's clearly call a bet and they say, sorry, that you're losing that money. But you don't have to put in 305 more, you know, because you just pushed 45 out. You know, to me, it's like, all right, you made the mistake. Clearly, it's a mistake, but it shouldn't be a $350 mistake. It should be a $340, you know, a $45 mistake, right, and then you learn from it. And they always say rule one in the best interest of the game. That's not, and we know it's TDA and that's not cash games. To me, it's a good rule to have no matter what you're doing in life, in the best interest of tennis, in the best interest of, you know, backpacking across Europe. I don't care. You need to have, you know, what's in the best interest of this situation right here? Making this poor guy pay 305 more or making him learn his lesson at 45, being grateful that he only lost 45, you know, and then the game moves on. Do you really think the guy who didn't get 305 is going to leave the card room and be upset because this guy clearly made a mistake? Or do you think the guy who has to put in 305 more is going to leave the poker room? You know what I mean? Are you going to lose a player? What situation are you going to lose a player more likely? That's the one I don't want to have happen, and so I go the other way with it. And I agree with Sam. I don't like that whole one chip means it. It's just so cavalier, too, and stupid, throwing one chip in the middle. Like, oh, I called because, look, here's a dollar. You know? Yeah. It's kind of silly. But, again, ultimately it does come down, this player should have been paying attention, but I don't think he should have had to pay that. It's like going to prison for 10 years for, you know, spitting in public. And that's just not right.
It depends who you spit on.
Yeah. Oh, I think I spit on somebody, you know.
So a couple things I want to say is, one, this whole one-chip thing was a huge controversy at the TDA Summit 2 years ago, and we're getting ready to hear in a couple months to have this year. So I'll be interested to see whether it comes up again. And I think, generally speaking, most poker managers are with Sam and with us on this, that it's just bad, the single chip thing.
Yeah.
And it causes a lot of unintentional problems, and here is one of them. You know, if no one had ever started this one chip thing, I'm almost sure that all seven of the people that gave a ruling on this thing would have said, hey, sorry, that 45 is going to stay, but you can fold, which is what is generally the ruling in these cases, right? This right. just happens to be a rule that the casino that, you know, likes the single chip rule. And, you know, obviously, hopefully, as Sam said, they're enforcing it consistently. That's the biggest issue. So if they're consistently saying every time you throw a chip in or 45 chips in, you are committing yourself to the all in, then that's fine. But the next thing I think is very interesting what Sam says is that, you know, some rooms do different rules to attract customers. So, in my opinion, this would be a rule that would make me not want to play in this casino.
Right.
And maybe it's a rule that would make other people want to play in the casino, you know. So I can't say it's bad or good. I know personally, if I knew that this is how consistently this casino enforces the single chip, I would choose to play elsewhere. Just because, you know, it doesn't happen to me very often when I'm not paying attention to the action, and I put a bet in where I think I'm calling, and I'm quite comfortable with the fact that if I make that mistake, that I know that I'm going to forfeit the bet I put in. You know, that's my penance. But I would not feel comfortable playing in a room where if I made that mistake, now because of some, you know, trend in Europe, I now have to put 305 extra bucks in.
Yeah.
no reason. So I'm not going to give that casino my business. I'm going to go somewhere else. So I would think from a casino standpoint, that's something that they should look at is, you know, what side are players on this issue? And really, it comes down to the single chip thing. And what really bothers me about it, gives me the red S, is it's just so lazy, right? Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, we can't say call, can't push all of our chips in. Somehow somebody decided that's just, oh boy, I'm so exhausted. Thank
God. These chips are so heavy.
Oh my God, can someone help me push these in? And they're just, I can't get them in. You know what? I'm going to start a trend where I just throw a chip in and be done with it.
It requires so much effort. No wonder why Cosenza thinks poker's a sport. I can only throw one chip in.
I mean, that's really what it is to me. I'm like, come on, folks. You know, be lazy on your couch at home when you're watching Rounders for the 18th time. You know, don't be lazy if you're all-in call at the table.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm predisposed to that. But, yeah, I mean, personally, I would not play in this room if I knew that was the consistent ruling. And, you know, maybe if enough players in this room said that, then they would change it. And like I said, maybe there's some other players are happy that they do this. So, you know, it's not what I think or what you think. It's just what you as a player and where you choose to play. So,
and the thing that gets me, too, is when that four person comes over and the shift boss comes over, it has to be the poker room's policy then. Because when you look and you see 45 bucks point in front of one guy, 305 or 50 in front of another, and then 45 in front of another, it's obvious he's not angle shooting by putting exactly 45 out there. You know, there's just no way that guy's angle shooting with that bet. He clearly made a mistake. Don't make this player hate your poker room and badmouth it forever. Because, you know, it's common sense. There's 45 there, 350 there, and 45 there. You know that guy was calling 45. You're a human being with a brain in your head, and rule number one in TDA, which I know doesn't apply here but doesn't matter, is what's best for the game.
Right, right.
And so, yeah, you're right. I would not want to play in a poker room that would not have common sense in that manner. You know, it's one thing to throw one chip out. Imagine if the guy threw a dollar out there.
Yeah.
Oh, really? He meant to call five or $400, $350,
well, I mean,
whatever one.
That's what I was going to get at here. Is if you're really buying into this whole one chip thing and you think this is greatest thing since sliced bread and you wanted to have it in your poker room, all right, that's fine. But how about just making it where it has to be a single chip?
Yeah,
single chip or all your chips. Anything in between is obviously a miscommunication of what's going on and reverts to what most rooms do and you just forfeit what you put in. You know, I mean, I think that's where would really bother me about this is like, you know, all right, I understand the single chip call thing, but obviously I put 45 chips in.
Yeah.
If I was so lazy that I didn't want to put 350 in, do you think I'm actually going to spend the time to put 45 in instead of just throwing one chip in?
Exactly. Exactly.
Common sense. It's
clearly common sense. That's right. Hey, you know what I just found, Scott? What
did you find?
I just found a brand new O'Malley's move. Let's hear it.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we're seated at a $4-$8 Omaha 8 game. We're the youngest at the table, and there seems to be a lot of calling stations. We bought in for $200 and currently sit with $150, down about $50. The action is seven-handed. We're in the big blind and post, as does the small blind. The under-the-gun folds, plus one calls, MP calls, hijack calls, button raises to eight, small blind calls, and we look down at the king of hearts, king of spades, queen of hearts, nine of spades. Yeah, the nine in one-way hand really aren't the greatest, but I just can't fold these kings. We call. Plus one calls, MP calls, hijack calls, and we're going to a flop with about $40 in the pot. The flop comes down the king of clubs, jack of hearts, eight of hearts. This is a pretty decent flop for us. We've got the nuts right now and redraws to top boat, and if the ace of hearts comes, we'll have the nut flush. The small blind checks and we bet. Plus one folds, MP calls, hijack folds, and the button raises us to $8. Small blind folds, we make it 12. It's folded back around to the button who caps it and we call. Nut flush draw? With nearly $80 in the pot, we're met with some mixed emotions as the four of hearts comes off on the turn. I really don't like this card, and I hate being out of position. We check. After a bit of thought, our opponent checks behind. Huh? The Button is an older guy who knows what he's doing and loves to talk at the table. He's been drinking a bit tonight and has become quiet during this hand. He takes the game seriously, but likes to have fun and joke around at the same time. I'm really not sure why he'd check here, but I'm definitely going to proceed with caution. The river is the tray of clubs. This completes the low, and there was already a flush possible. We're still in caution mode with the second nuts, so we check. This time our opponent bets. What's the move?
All right, it's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. Another one from our good friend Jason Grimes this week. And he said this came from a Saturday night at the World Series of Poker Circuit in Tunica, Mississippi.
Nice.
And he gave us two hands. So the first one, he gave us a little information, but the second hand is the better one, I think. So we're going to forego whatever information we learned on the first hand, and we'll just jump in hand two fresh, right?
So, all right.
All right. So let's see. It says the table is the first hand, things were a little crazy, but now the table has returned to a quote-unquote normal 1-3 game where we don't see $30 pre-flop bets, and people tend to respect what others are representing. So probably why I selected this hand, because now it's a little bit normal, right?
Yeah.
In this hand, we're under the gun, and we have 1,200 in front of us.
Wow.
Yeah, not bad. So, I mean, this first hand was really crazy, I guess, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
All right, we have four of clubs, four of spades.
Huh. Well, I got to tell you.
I just would be worried if after I do the initial setup, you don't go, huh. I'm going to think, you know, this is some other alternate person is taking over your body.
Oh, man. I don't know. I would probably just limp. I'm not the kind of guy that raises with 4-4. I'm out of position the rest of the way. If I got to put up a whole charade with 4-4, you know, I'm just like, eh. I might as well just fold. So I think I'm just going to limp and set mine. If somebody puts in some sort of mediocre raise, because he just said that they're not putting in these gargantuan raises anymore. So right. If it gets around to, like, I don't know, the cutoff and he makes it 12, I might call 12. But I certainly don't want to put out 12 or 15 with 4-4 and then have it go 45. And then now I'm set mining with putting out, you know, $50. So I don't know. I mean, I'll probably just limp. I really don't feel like raising. I don't know. If I'm being honest, a lot of times I'll just limp with a 4-4.
Yeah, to me, this is a folder race. I can't limp here. I mean, I get the idea behind the limping is that we're set mining, we're trying to get in cheap, but two reasons I don't like it. One, I like to be consistent with my bets, so I'm not going to decide, you know, if I had ace-ace here, am I going to limp? No. I'm gonna raise, right? Mm-hmm. If I have seven-deuce here, am I going to limp? No, I'm going to fold, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm either going to fold or raise in under the gun. I'm not going to limp. So the fact that all of a sudden now I've decided to limp, if folks are paying attention, they're going to like, all right, he hasn't limped under the gun ever, and he has raised here, and he has folded here, so what kind of hands do you limp with? Small pocket pairs probably fit right into your range, right? So I'm kind of giving some information away. So the other thing, too, is that, you know, so I'm going to raise or fold, and you're right, I don't really feel like I want to get into some kind of, you know, bravado thing here with 4-4 under the gun. So it's probably a case for me to fold. And it's a cash game, you know, so it's not a tournament where I'm pressing the action. The tournament's a different story. You know, I know people, oh my gosh, throwing away a pair. But it's just a pair, you know, right now. Yeah. And, you know, the flop is not going to be good for you unless a 4 comes. You know, there's not a lot of good flops with pocket 4s, right?
Right.
You know, you're probably going to get 3 overs, and that's going to be tough, or at least 2 overs. And, so you're going to need a lot of help here. So if you're not willing to raise, which is setting up some help, because now you're thinning the field and you're representing all kinds of different hands and you have all kinds of options that you didn't have if you limped, then I would raise. But, you know, that's why I just can't limp here. I got to either raise or fold. And if I raise, I'm going to represent that I got a hand. I'm not worried about the set mining. It'd be nice if I hit my 4. That'd be great, right?
Right.
But I retain a lot of options to continue playing this hand that way I want. And if I fold, then, you know, the only thing I got to worry about is if a 4 comes in the flop, then I could do the great boogly-boogly and wait for the next hand. But if it doesn't, then I'm just like, you know what? All right, so I save $2, or $3, I think it is. And
all right, let me ask you two questions. Well, actually, I want to make a point and then ask you a question. as being the under-gun player, sometimes a limp is suspicious. So now you've got to kind of, if they're paying attention,
that's true.
It's that kind of table.
Then you've got to play that. You got to play that story now, and that's more dangerous, I think, than just raising, isn't it?
I don't know. Maybe you don't have to play the story. Because you miss the flop and you check, and they bet you fold.
I'm gonna be fishy with my limp, right? And if somebody raises on the button, then to tell that story accurately, now you've got to raise him, right?
Well, unless you're being sneaky again, you're just calling with aces.
Oh my gosh!
There are some people who just call with aces. No.
Yeah, I guess. But at some point, you're going to have to make that story make sense, and that's going to involve a pretty big bet. And what I'm hearing is we're going to limp because we're not confident about this hand we're set mining. And so if we're putting that whole evil plan down to hitting another sailboat, then I think we're in trouble.
Okay, and then the question I wanted to ask you is there ever a situation in a 1-3 game where you have $1,200 in front of you and you're first in that you would limp?
Okay, well, yeah. I mean, there is some situational thing. Okay? We're sitting on a big, big stack. Of course, we don't know what other people have to have this table either, too. So,
right.
I mean, we're impressed at 1,200 to 1-3. That's got to be, if not the chip leader.
Yeah, he's got a big stack.
And there's got to be quite a few players with less, I would think. But I don't necessarily think I'm going to loosen up there. I mean, obviously, I've gotten that stack somehow, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, and, you know, I know Jason's submitted before, but it's tough for me to remember exactly how he plays. I guess somebody's going to say, yeah, I've got all this money, so I'm going to throw it in and maybe I'll get lucky and I'll make a lot of money. You know, it's kind of like that, you know, scratch off ticket kind of, you know, theory. You know, you go there, you get 5 scratch off tickets and then you just keep reinvesting that money. Like, hey, now I'm playing with somebody else's money.
Right.
Until an hour later, you're looking down and you just spent $20 and got nothing to show for you but a bunch of scratched off cardboard. So I think that's kind of the same thing here. Yeah, I mean, $3 when you got $1,200 is nothing, and if you hit your big end, great. But, you know, if you keep doing that and you're here for another 4 hours, you know, it's going to add up.
Well, I'm asking actually a different question. I'm saying, is there ever a point where you'd limp? Is there any hand in any situation when you're first to act, not first to act, but first to enter the pot?
First to enter pot.
Right.
No, I just don't see a reason to. I just don't. I mean, obviously, if I'm second to act and there's something else, then yeah, there's all kinds of times I'm just going to call or limp. And definitely with fours, I would love that opportunity. But first in, no, I think you just give up so much value by not raising first in. And I think you'll find, if you go back to we get every other case now with his, you know, new spreadsheet that he's going to be working on here, if he actually gets to the point where you spreadsheet some of this stuff, I think you'll find that first in the pot limping is long-term a negative EV play, I would think. I don't have any facts to back that up right now. I would think it probably is, though, for most players.
Okay. I was just curious, because I know you've always been the proponent of you know, first in raising. But I just, when I'm up a bunch...
Well, the other thing,
too,
is if I'm playing at a table with players that are clearly better than me, which is, I don't know why you'd be doing that as a cash game, because you could just get up and leave, right? But
right.
I might just be very passive pre-flop anyhow. You know, I might just limp all my hands. I might limp all my aces, queens, kings, and my fours. And if that's the case, then that's great. And then no one can ever put me on a hand here, and I'm limping. And when I do hit, I'm going to big pig. That would be the case I would do it. And I've been known to do that from time to time. But again, that's just a justification for being in a game you shouldn't be in.
Okay. You know, for me, when I'm up a bunch, I tend to speculate a lot. That's how I win most of my money. So a lot of times,
right.
I'm playing all kinds of hands.
Doesn't mean under the gun first.
No, I understand. But to me, it would mean that for me. If my buy-in was 200 and I'm up to 1,200 or 300 and I'm up to, you know, 4 times my buy-in, I'm playing every hand. I'm just playing. You know, unless it's absolutely atrocious, I'm just throwing chips in there and I want to see what they're going to do. Because now that I've showed them that I've destroyed this table, all of a sudden, this under the gun guy limps with 4-4, but he only has 4-4. All of a sudden, he limps and he's up 4 buy-ins. They're going to be like, "What is going on over there?" And no one's going to raise me. You know what I mean? If they do raise me, then maybe I do. Then say, "Now I change my okay." Originally, I didn't want to go rogue on this and start, you know, going crazy and raising with 4-4. But now that I have sort of got this persona of, "Hey, he's won 4 buy-ins already." And he's limping under the gun, and now somebody's choosing to raise me. Well, then maybe I fold, or maybe I bust out a re-raise and see if this guy really had a raise, didn't believe me, because then he might just shove, and then I know he had ace-ace, and he was hoping I would raise. Who knows? But, I mean, when I have that many buy-ins already under my belt in my stack in a 1-3 game, I'm splashing a lot. And a lot of the ways I splash is just to limp. They have no idea what I have. And then I just can totally play all kinds of different ways, you know, all these different personas after that. And so, to me, I don't mind the limp there, especially if, like you said, it's calmed down now. So even if the guy goes, all right, well, I'll make it 12. And then to me, now I've got 1,200 in front of me. I've got 1,012 bets there if that guy goes 12.
Right,
so I'm thinking, all right, well, all right, I'll call your 12. And then you're still sort of selling. Now you pop a set, but it's all babies, and he's thinking maybe you were being sneaky with an overpair. And now you've got a set. You know, I mean, I don't know. It's just, to me, there's a lot of
value. I'm definitely going to loosen it up. I'm definitely going to speculate. I'm just going to choose better spots to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think I need to go all the way crazy where I'm speculating every single hand and limping under gun or first in. I would take that out of my speculation range and, you know, maybe do some suited one gappers in position that I would normally play or something like that. So I'm still going to speculate. I get what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I just don't know if this is the spot I'm going to speculate, no matter how much money I have in front of me.
How many times have you been in a table, too, though, when the under the gun limps and the other guy limps, and all of a sudden it sets off this sort of sprinkler head, everyone limps.
Sure, absolutely.
You know what I mean? So now all of a sudden you've got this huge, you know, price on your money to hit that set now because everyone just limps because nobody wants to play the hand. Generally, everybody folds anyway. So now if you're limping, you incur someone else to limp, then you get other limpers. Now, yeah, you might get some guy saying, oh, look at all that dead money I'm going to raise. But a lot of times, I can't tell you how many times I see free flops and cash games on the cruises.
That's true. But then I think you got to be consistent with it, though, again, is what I think. So, and I don't think anybody really feels comfortable limping with aces there. I mean, some people do, obviously, and then doing the, ha-ha, gotcha.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then I would want to do the, ha-ha, gotcha with my fours here as well, too. So,
yeah,
and I'm not comfortable doing that.
It also relies on the turnover at that table. You know what I mean? If you're playing a cash game, very often you're all of a sudden you look up and you got six new guys there because everyone's busted. So, you know, yeah, your consistency and the stories you're telling and the persona you have are only as good as the people who are around you that have been there long enough too. So all that stuff plays into it. Just for fun, since you like to raise, I'm gonna stick with the limp so that you and I can sort of have different on this. So I limped.
All right, our hero limps as well, too.
Oh, after all that, he rides!
It doesn't mean it's a good play yet.
I know.
All right, so let's see. Folds the villain. I'm trying to think where he told me the villain was in this hand. Do not remember where the villain is, but the villain raises to... Oh, I'm sorry. Villain is in the 2 seat, but that doesn't help me because I don't know what seat we're in.
Right, ultimately, he's going to have position on us the rest of the hand.
Right.
So we could just say he...
All right, so anyhow, both of the villain who raises to 13.
Okay.
And there are two callers, including the dealer and the big... the button and the big blind when it gets back to us. So there we go. So he's somewhere... The villain's somewhere in between us and the button.
All right, so we got 39 plus our 3s. So we basically got $40 in there to call 10. So we're getting plenty of money. I think for with the implied odds of making a set in a multi-way pot, I don't mind calling that $10 more. Like I said, if it's going to be 12, you know what I mean? I was going to call it anyway for just heads up. Now I've got two other callers with 13, so I'm getting good. I know it's 8 to 1 to flop a set, but that doesn't matter. With the implied odds and everything, this is worth it. So I'm calling.
Yeah, all right. I'm going to call now too here.
Okay.
All right, so pot is $46, and the flop is the deuce of hearts, tray of clubs, 5 of diamonds.
That's so funny, because when you were saying about the only set you want, only flop you want, you benefit from is a 4, I was thinking in my head, what about 2, 3, 5? I was thinking that exact thing, and that's what came out. That's great. I love that flop. We're under the gun, but we're not... This is a big blind his first act, right?
Yeah, let's see. It looks like he doesn't say specifically, but yeah, he must have checked to us. So,
okay.
Action's on us now.
I don't mind betting. I mean, one, it's very well these guys didn't have pocket pairs, but if they did, you know, they might have something like... I would think the big blind, if he had hand, he might bet, but he might be checking to the raise or the check raise, so that's hard to know. But I don't mind putting on a little bit of a bet out here, like $20.
Yeah, well, it's interesting now is I'm trying to figure out what kind of story we can tell, because if we did the whole limp with a big hand thing,
mm-hmm.
normally we would have came alive pre-flop, right? After the
after the two callers, 13. Absolutely. Plus the
exactly.
two callers. Absolutely.
So I don't know whether we can really sell that story now, right?
Right.
Unless we were just really cavalier about it. So I think I might just have to check here because I don't know what kind of story I can tell. I mean, now I guess if I bet, now I guess I'm saying maybe an overpair that's not good enough to re-raise the guy. You know, eights or nines or something. Mm-hmm. But even that, I mean, are you all of a sudden you feel emboldened with your pair of nines on this board when you still have a villain that raised to 13?
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm going to check here and let that villain put his C bet in, and then at that point maybe I can raise if I feel like it or have some other options. You know, if we put it out now, obviously we're open-ended, so we kind of like our hand. We got a lot of possibilities, and it's hidden, right? So, but I don't know if I want to make this hand too expensive right now. And we bet whatever, $25, $30 or something, and the villain raises us to 75, 8, or 100, something like that. Is that what we want out of this hand right now?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we're open-ended. We have a pair, or that second pair to the board. And, you know, villain could add ace-king. You know, I don't know. I don't really believe the dealer has that.
Let's let him drive the action and keep this hand hidden a little bit and then make him really figure out when we hit this hand. Or, you know, we don't have to necessarily hit this hand. We can get more active later on. But right now, I think I'd let him set the price, and you know, maybe we pick up a couple callers, and then maybe at that point we can raise too if we want, if we feel really comfortable about it. I think betting outright here is, I don't know, it's going to have adverse effects somehow. I don't really know how right now, but
are you calling me a donkey? Are you saying that I made a donk bet by betting into the reason?
Maybe a little bit.
All right, well, I'm gonna stick with my bet of like 20-25, and you stick with your check. Let's see what happens.
All right, our hero says, I like this flop. Hopefully everyone else is playing high cards, so I might already be ahead. For those who are playing a high pocket pair, I'm open-ended. Outside of a flop set, I feel pretty good. I bet $25.
It's like I sent you the hand of the week.
Yeah, exactly.
That's weird.
I'm definitely in the minority here today, so see how it turns out. All right, the villain raises to 55, and everyone folds and back to us. So I guess this is what I was... I mean, it's not that big of a raise, but... I'm wondering what the villain would have bet had we not bet.
Yeah, he wouldn't have bet 55.
Right. So that's what I'm kind of wondering. Obviously, if we end up, this hand goes our way at the end, we'll be ecstatic that we did this right now.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Right now, I can't be certain that I'm ahead right now. I mean, it seems like he thinks he is. But there's no reason at this point to believe that the villain doesn't have a big pocket pair himself.
I tell you, it would be awesome if he had aces and an ace came on a turn, like an ace of diamonds or ace of, you know.
And what wouldn't be awesome is if he has aces and a four comes. Right?
Yeah.
Actually, he wouldn't even need aces. He would just need ace king at that point, and that would suck. So,
I'll call the. What do we bet? 25, and he bet 55. Yeah. So I'll call the 30.
Yeah, I think we have to call. I mean, I'm not saying I'm going to fold here. I just would have rather have seen that next card a little cheaper. And not giving him any information on my hand.
Yeah, I guess it matters, too, to see what the dealer will do when he bets that 55, right?
Well, no, it's folded back to us now, so.
Oh, okay, it's folded. Well, no, but the dealer would still be after us. Right?
No, we're under the gun.
Oh, the villain bet, then the dealer folded to us. Exactly. Okay, all right, so it's your heads up. Yeah, I'll just call and see what happens.
All right, so our hero says, I decide I'm still okay with the pair on an open-ended. I call. Pot's now 156, and the turn is the tray of hearts. So we are a deuce of hearts, tray of clubs, five of diamonds, tray of hearts.
Yeah, I guess you got to check and see what he's going to do. If he checks behind, then I'm going to try to steal it on the end. If he bets a big number, I'm not sure what I'll do.
Yeah, now we got a flush draw to worry about and stuff. So this hand could get really bad really quickly. So. Yeah. All right, so that's what we do. We check. The villain bets 40.
Oh, I'm calling 40.
Yeah, I think
it's a big pot, you know, and you still have a pair that's. Well, he only bet 40. That makes me even wonder exactly like you said. What would he bet on the flop if he bet 40 here? That's not even a quarter of the pot.
Yeah, so I'm a little worried that. Wow. Ugh.
I'm still calling.
Pocket threes, really?
Yeah, I don't know.
Hope not. But I would think, I mean, it's a weird bet, isn't it? It's a very weird bet.
Pocket threes is quads. There's no way he's betting. I mean, I would think you would check behind, hope we try to steal it on the end, and then get his bed in if you make quads. So pocket
five. But on the other hand, it's a 2 week of a bet, isn't it?
It is. It's a weak bet.
Maybe it's a bet like, hey, I want to call. It's a bet you put out when you hit your hand and you don't want to lose them, but you don't want to lose value, right? And I don't know what that is on this board.
Ace, four of diamonds. suited ace. I don't know. That's bizarre. Two, three,
yeah, or
five,
4-6 is the only straights, and then that doesn't make sense.
I wouldn't raise a 4-6.
I mean, I suppose maybe it's pocket fives or pocket deuces, and now he's got a boat.
Could just be an overpair, and he's just thinking that we had something like eights or something, and just trying to make us call. I don't think he's worried about the
possibility, but I think I'd bet a little bit more even if I did that at eight.
Right. I mean, it could be a brain fart. I mean, he bet 55 after we bet 25.
Right.
You know, he doesn't know how to understand betting, or maybe he's just not.
I'm sure of that. Yeah.
who knows? But I'm gonna call.
Yeah. I mean, it's priced pretty nicely here too. So, all right. Here says, I now believe I'm behind an overpair, but I'm getting the right odds to call. I think I am, as long as the third, four, or an ace or a six hit, so I call. The river is the six of diamonds. So our final board is two of hearts, tray of clubs, five of diamonds, tray of hearts, six of diamonds.
Mm-hmm. Here's the deal. You do have to worry about the full house, so I don't even mind check calling here, because the pot's a decent size. You've already put 100 in this pot. I don't mind check calling because the board's paired, believe it or not. Because I'm not going to be the kind of, I got to get value for my hand, and then all of a sudden the guy, you bet out 75, and all of a sudden he makes it 225. Now you've lost $300 on his hand because the guy really did have pocket fives, or something. So I don't mind check calling. If I check and he puts out a bet of like 80 or 90, I'm happy calling with the straight. Because even that, the six there now, you don't have the nuts. Not that. You still have like the 17th best hand there with that straight.
Right,
so,
right.
I don't mind check calling.
Yeah, I mean, here's the other thing too, I know there's a lot of people out there that just feel like they have to get some more value out of this hand, but I think this is the reminder, a good reminder of that we're out of position. And when you're out of position, you're limited in how much value you can get out of your hand, and you run yourself into trouble by trying to squeeze every dollar you can out of it. I mean, here, I think you're right. I'm happy check, and he's going to bet, I would think. There's no reason for him not to, based on how he's been betting. Make that call and turn it over, and then have the guy go, whoosh, God, I'm glad you didn't raise me.
Yeah.
And be like, all right, fine. And take down the nice pot here. If we, bet into him now, it's going to be kind of odd. And, if we raise later, I don't know. I'm happy just check calling.
Yeah. Well, we agree.
All right. So our hero says, obviously the river is six of diamonds. Give me the nuts with an exclamation point.
That's not the nuts.
Well, I suppose I could be behind 4-7 for the higher straight, but that seems unlikely. He seems to be missing the paired board, I think, right?
Yeah, the quads, the full houses.
A pot has 236 in it, and our opponent has 292. I think about what bet sizing makes the most sense, and then grab a handful of black chips. Over the night, I've slowly been cultivating them. Changing out a stack of $5 red chips for $100 bills when someone needs a change made. Because I have a personal preference for chips versus bills, but no one else seems to have the same preference. And then converting the bills to $100 black chips. So my stack looks stupid for a 1-3 game. I have maybe $200 in red $5 chips, and the rest is $100 black and $1 white chips. Pretty funny.
Oh, man.
And I just sort of throw them at the pot. I end up betting $500. She begins to contemplate a call. I look back at the board. 2, 3, 5, 3, 6. Oh, crap. You know what else a raise could have meant? Not an overpair, a flop set. And one set plus one pair on the board equals Jason is doomed. These are things that begin to go into my head. Not the nuts, not the second nuts, or third or fourth, just a straight. Gah!
Oh, man.
As I start to come to grips with how stupid I am, she finally finds a call and turns over ace of diamonds, ace of clubs.
Ace. Perfect.
Wow. Where I didn't see the possible full house, she later said she didn't see the straight and never gave me credit for a tray in my hand for a set. So, how badly did I screw it up and not even seeing the full house or giving the idea of a flop set any credit to her initial flop raise?
The flop set doesn't really get me, only because It just seems weird that somebody would raise 13 after you limped with 2-2, 3-3, 5-5. It doesn't seem right to me. I would think they would limp along two because they're trying to set mine.
Right, exactly.
So I wouldn't have put them on the sets. It's possible still. I mean, obviously anything's possible given what it's poker. But the ace-ace really did make sense to me. Not ace-ace, but an overpair made sense. Just the fact.
Yeah.
But you're right, though. The betting was horrible. If you have an overpair of that board, you know, ace-ace, she's happy with it because she's got the straight draw, too.
And particularly that turn. The turn...
Now you want to put the hammer down.
Now you've got two pair there now, right? So even if you're up against some idiot that flopped five deuce or something, now you've got him beat now.
Yeah.
And you've got, you know, a redraw to the boat in case you're behind for some reason. And you gotta worry about the straights and the flushes. You gotta think what everybody else is in this hand for. And so, you know, either somebody's got the smaller, or, I mean, like a pocket eights, like we're talking about, at that point you want them to pay more for it, right?
Yeah.
Or they're drawing and you want them to pay more for it. There's no scenario here where I don't want to bet more of my pocket aces on that board.
Yeah, when he bet 25,
particularly
when
my last opponent is under the gun, so I can't put him really on any hand that connects with any of this.
That raise was not enough on the turn. And then the raise on the flop, and then the $40 bet in the turn was really weird with ace ace there. You want to protect that hand.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I know you're saying, oh, I hit the four, I'm in my wheel, but, you know, that's no. Plus the flush draw gets picked up, like you mentioned, you know, the three of hearts on the turn. So that's an interesting bet that she made. I disagree with both her bets, and, We were lucky that she didn't have a boat already, or even somehow the better straight, which is ridiculous. 4-7 is not there,
right? But, yeah, exactly.
But ace-ace, yeah, that kind of made sense. Good thing we didn't go crazy with Scott and raise with 4-4 preflop, and then get re-raised and then call or try to be the I'm going to represent the big hand. But
We would have ended up. It would have been very much a lot more money in the pot, but we still would have won this probably, right? Because here's what would happen, I think. Let's say I make it 15 to go, which is probably what I'd make in a 1-3 or 12 or something like that, whatever. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the aces are going to raise this, I think, right? Because they raised it to 13. So now I got to call that raise, probably, unless it's a sick raise, right? Then the flop comes and I'm open-ended. You know, this isn't, I want to hit my four, but now I'm intrigued, right? So unless I'm going to check and then, you know, I mean, we bet 25, they raised to 55. So let's say we check and they bet 40. I'm not going to throw this away for 40, right?
Uh-huh.
So now I'm in for 40. And now the turn is really what it comes down to. I mean, the turn is where I could get pushed off this hand by a proper bet by the villain. But the villain's going to let me see that last card for 40? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then, bam, I hit it. And, you know, ricky-ticky-tabby.
So your scenario, so
would
still make the same money.
Much. Yeah, I don't think it would change anything, really, based on how the hand actually played out, but, you know, obviously we're talking about before we knew how the hand was going to play out.
Right. Huh.
Kind of interesting how that all works out.
Yeah, it's because the other guys would have folded to the re-raise of the villain, so you would have been heads up, and so the same amount of money still would have gotten there somehow because the raises would have represented what the dealer and the big blind called, essentially. So you essentially got the same pot size. And then the bets all come down the same way,
right?
Again.
Just in a different way.
Different
now,
way.
I will say the weakness in what I was talking about is that the reason you're raising out of the gun is you're selling that story that you've got a really strong hand, right?
Right.
So now, when you get raised by the end of the gun plus two or whatever it is, right? Now you probably should be re-raising, right?
Right.
If you just call, now you've just killed that story. So now you're hoping to hit something, which is really bad. And you know, as it was, we hit something, and then we end up getting there. So. You know, I guess that's the other problem. That's the problem with raising there. You almost need to fold at that point unless you're feeling ready to 3-bet.
Would you have just called with ace-king after that, though? If you say you raise ace-king under the gun and somebody re-raises you, you might just call ace-king.
But then I can't really represent ace-king on that board after that.
Well, no, that, yeah.
Maybe.
With ace for the wheel.
You know.
But that's an interesting hand.
Huh. Yeah.
See, you said, huh. All right, Jason, thanks for the hand, buddy. Another good show. I'm Chris Cosenza.
I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Ante Up is a production of AnteUpMagazine.com. Contact the show at podcast@AnteUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 206-338-6344. If you'd like to advertise, send an email to advertising@AnteUpMagazine.com. or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.